honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Calvin Pacetta, spent 30 years in the U.S. Navy, from before America entered World War II, through the Korean War, the Cold War, and even the Vietnam War. His brother Jimmy was wounded in World War II, and even their father, a World War I veteran, was in the Navy in World War II as well. His father had been part of the original crew of the USS Indianapolis, the cruiser that was famously sunk in late July 1945, just weeks before the formal surrender of Imperial Japan. If you haven't had a chance to read it yet, I highly recommend the bestseller Indianapolis, the true story of the worst sea disaster in U.S. naval history and the 50-year fight to exonerate an innocent man. That's the title. I highly recommend it. And if you have read it, you know that the commander of the Japanese sub that sank the Indy, Mochitsura Hashimoto, actually came to the U.S. after the war to testify in the investigation into what really happened in that tragedy. But on April 1st, 1946, our guest today, Calvin Pacetta, participated in the destruction of that sub, the I-58, as well as 25 other Japanese submarines, and you actually ended up hearing a firsthand account of the Indianapolis's sinking. Tell me about what you learned in this Operation Deep Six, I think you called it.
Before that, we were patrolling these submarines, and the I-58, you know, everybody knows, was the Japanese submarine that sunk the Indianapolis. And being that I was on a patrol security boat, trolling all these subs, we would stop and check the crew and everything. And on the I-58, this one crew member was talking to me, and he was telling me about the Indianapolis when they sunk it. And he was very sorry, very devastated about it, because they knew that the war was almost over, but they still had to do their job, he says. And his captain, I guess, had to sink the Indianapolis. The Indianapolis was sailing with their running lights on because they thought it was safe.
And at the time they sank the Indianapolis, which of course had delivered the components of the nuclear bomb to Tinian to facilitate the Enola Gay and all of that, they sink the Indianapolis, but they don't know that American forces are going to be blind to where the Indianapolis is for days, and that so many of the survivors of the sinking are going to be eaten by sharks in the days that followed. So it was that awareness of knowing what happened to those guys that upset him?
Exactly, yes, that's exactly what he said. Yeah, that's what really upset him the most, and knowing that the war was almost over too. But he was so devastated about it, he was kind of crying and everything else. And where the connection is, like, my dad put the Indianapolis in commission. I helped sink the submarine I-58, so I was one of the handy persons to help sink it. And not only me, but our captain on the submarine tender had some of the guns that was on the ship fire at the I-58 itself, so everybody had a chance to sink it. And they had even planes coming over and drop bombs on it, because they knew it was the ones that sunk the Indianapolis.
And you told me something else about that. You know, here you have more than two dozen Japanese submarines that still have a skeleton crew, and you guys are going to be disposing of them so you can disarm Japanese forces. But those crew members initially didn't want to come with you? They wanted to go down with the ship? Did that really happen?
Yes, it did. Not on the I-58, but one of the first submarines that we sank. We took the crew out. The crew was a skeleton crew on all these submarines that went out. And well, we set the charges and figured, well, they're going to get off, you know, right away. But evidently, they didn't want to get off. They wanted to go down with the ship. So they had to send for Marines to come aboard, pull these guys off. But after that happened, so we did set the charges, so all the crews were off.
I mean, you said they wanted to discharge you when the World War II was over, and you said, no, I want to stay in the Navy. But did you ever get a chance after the war to catch up with your father, with your brother? Here you are, three World War II veterans, they're in the same family, and share with each other some of those things you'd been through.
Oh, yeah, we did. we all, you know, family reunion, we got together with all our family, which was big at that time, nine of us all together. And yeah, we often talked about what happened and everything and how lucky our family is that we all survived the World War II that was.
Well, and I've heard a lot of perspectives on that. And some people will say, you know, just that, it was luck and what was going to be was going to be. Other people said they were convinced that there was somebody else that was looking out for them. How did you feel about that whole situation?
Definitely. Somebody had to be watching out for me to keep me off of the USS Princeton, which a lot of my friends went down with it. The USS Princeton got sunk in Lingayen Gulf in the Philippines, which I was there at the time. I did not see the sinking or anything, but I heard about it. And I knew all of my friends that were on there that got transferred on there, and just thinking who survived and who didn't survive. And I'll never know to this day completely if any of them really survived, which I think they did, because most of the crew did get off on the USS Princeton. But there again, God must have been with me, or somebody must have been saving me, keep me from being aboard that ship.
And even your first ship, the New Mexico, and I know because I've interviewed a guy who was wounded when a kamikaze hit their bridge. I mean, to know that the first ship you were on suffered severe damage and had a significant loss of life.
Yeah, that again, I keep thinking of the friends that I had on there, you know, especially when I heard about the one that hit this bridge. I believe there was a 500-pound one that hit it, plus I think they got hit by a kamikaze too, and it killed the captain. And I missed that one too, so somebody had to be watching me.
And apparently you wanted to make them work a little harder, because a few years later, you're back in another war. Did that catch you by surprise, the American involvement in Korea?
Not really. You know, we heard rumors that the stuff was going on over there. It was bad. We were coming back from a med cruise over in the Mediterranean, making all these nice ports and everything at Cannes, France and everything. And we got our orders to say, hey, you guys get back into Norfolk and get ready to go to Korea. Boy, that kind of shook my bottom, I'll tell you. Back over there in Korea. And we got over there on the USS Barton and going in this harbor. And one of the cruisers, I think it was the USS Pittsburgh, you know, I'm 95. My brain isn't as active as it used to be, but stuff like this sticks in your brain. And a cruiser was coming out, and they were firing on the cruiser, and this other cruiser was both coming out, and we were going in. We were headed in there because our guns were small, and we could reach in there where the firing was coming from. So we got in. The captain got in so close that we got caught at this crossfire, and we got hit, one up in the chief's quarters. One of us got it in a stack, went right down a stack. It killed one of my best friends, which I kind of take responsible for because he was one of my gun crew. He was sick, and he wasn't doing me any good, so I asked him to go down to the sick bay and see if he could get something to take care of. In the meantime, we got under attack. The shell hit exactly where he was at. And I felt so bad. When I opened the hatch, he had half of his intestines was kind of hanging out, and he had another shell went through his neck, but he was still alive, amazingly. You know, I patched him up as best I could, you know, and tried to comfort him, which I doubt if he even heard what I was saying. I had to carry him up to the sick bay, and he passed away. And I always feel responsible for that. I always have.
What was his name?
His name was Dale Gray. I always felt bad, very bad. But just one of them things that happens, you know.
Well, it happened to over 400,000 Americans in World War II and more than 50,000 in Korea and close to 60,000 in Vietnam. And you've been to all those memorials in Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. I want to ask you about that in a moment. But I've got an article here. You weren't on the Barton anymore. You're on another destroyer, the USS Irwin. And here's an article from the newspaper more than 65 years ago. It says, USS Irwin, Calvin T. Pacetta, GM1, recently proved that one fast man is as good as 13 slow ones, for a few minutes anyway, when this ship was taken under fire by a deeply entrenched enemy gun in Wonsan Harbor. The word was passed to man all of the ship's 5-inch guns. Pasetta immediately bolted to the ammo room of the after gun mount, of which he is mount captain. Grabbing a 5-inch shell and powder charge, he stuffed them into their hoist, turned on the power, and started them on their way up to the mount. He then dashed up the ladder, climbed into the mount, rammed the shell and powder charge into the barrel, and settling into mount captain's position, reported ready to the gunnery control officer. The rest of his 13-man crew were at their stations before it became necessary to load the gun for the second time, much to the relief of the sweating gunner's mate. Now, I'm picturing that, and that it almost sounds impossible for you to do all those guys' jobs, and they gave you a citation for it here as well.
Well, all this incoming was coming at us, and, you know, stuff was dropping all around us and everything on the ship. And these guys was all ducking underneath different things, get underneath the torpedo tubes and here and there. And I was telling them, hey, if you're going to get hit, you're going to get killed, you know. So let's get in our mounts. They still wouldn't come, you know. So I said, well, they'll come eventually. So I just run in there and start doing my job. I put everything in automatic. Luckily, in them days, we did have things in automatic. So I was able to load the powder shell and the projectiles at this, you know, and put everything in automatic, run everything up topside, and loaded the gun and everything, put it in all in automatic. And it was all controlled by the main control of the fire control room. So all I had to do was load all this stuff up. So that's what I did. If I had to load another one, I would have. But fortunately, the crew was able to get in there and help me out. We silenced the battery, the enemy batteries that was shooting at us. We blew them up pretty good. Looking through the binoculars, we were so close that when we hit the gun battery, I could see the men, you know, flying through the air. Actually, that's how close we was to the shore. They did hit us a couple of times. One was up in the main mast, it almost knocked that right out. The other was up forward somewhere, up in front, forward of the ship. We got out of that mess pretty good.
You say they hit you a couple times, and they might have hit you more if you hadn't done what you did, which was described by your commander as courageous conduct and steadfast devotion to duty in keeping with the highest traditions of the U.S. Naval Service. And it sounds like, and I'm just picturing what I'm reading here from this article and that commendation, it sounds like when you said, hey, watch this, I'm going to do all your jobs and we're going to get firing at these guys, that it kind of inspired those other members of your crew and they snapped to it and did their jobs.
Yes, they did. After that, I had no problem. After we got fired on it, after that too, a couple of times, I had no problem with the crew coming in there. And I went on one of the reunions back in San Diego. These guys come running at me. I could hardly recognize them. They said, oh, there's our hero. That made me kind of feel good.
I imagine there was something else that made you feel good a few years ago when you went with Honor Flight Southern Nevada and Belinda Morse and her crew back to Washington, D.C. And it's been so many years here. You know, you were in World War II, in Korea, the start of the Vietnam War up till 1970. You work in the Anaheim School District for decades after that, managing a stadium down there. Here you retire to Las Vegas. And they take you back to a place that I'm guessing made a lot of those memories swirl around in your mind. What was that experience like with Honor Flight?
Oh, the Honor Flight was just, they're so wonderful, these people. You can't say enough about them. They were so great, helping us, all the guys in wheelchairs and everything else. All the people cheering us and everything, going through the airports, the honor guard at the airports and everything. When we got to Washington with the fire hose and the fire trucks from the airport, they honored the people coming in with these fire hoses shooting over the plane. On the way there and back, we had such wonderful people taking care of us, all the attendants, the plane attendants. They were singing all the military songs, and they had the whole plane singing these military songs, you know, and all the 1940 songs. Everybody was singing, not only the crew, but the passengers too. They were all singing. They were so wonderful to us. Then to see the memorial just brought tears to my eyes. You know, a lot of my friends are probably on that wall, you know. Kind of brought a lot of tears to my eyes. Very, very sad. Very sad.
Well, that's what I was wondering. What a guy like you thinks about in those moments as your group goes to the World War II Memorial and then the Korean War Veterans Memorial and, of course, that
that haunting Vietnam wall with 58,000 names on it. Is it fair to say that you had guys for each one of those that you knew in each one of those wars that didn't make it home?
Yes, I did. Yes, I knew quite a few of them that didn't make it home. Just in my memories, you know, forever and ever. I'll never forget them. You know, there's so many, like on New Mexico. There was so many on there. It was over 3,000 men, I think, at the time. I've been looking for this one guy. He has such a common name, Brown, because he gave me, everything was censored in them days. And he gave me this letter because I was going back to the States before him. He gave me this letter to mail when I got to the States. I mailed it, but I put it in another envelope, and the letter came back to me. I've looked this guy up for I don't know how many years. I never could find him. I think he probably perished on the New Mexico. He lived in San Francisco. His whole family was from San Francisco.
Well, you say that, you know, so many guys that you knew are represented by the gold stars of the World War II Memorial or everything, the different facets of the Korean Memorial and the names at Vietnam. How should we remember those guys? Those guys who didn't get to do what you got to do and come back and have a family and have this life? You're still in phenomenal shape at 95. How should you remember those other guys who didn't come home?
Just of the stuff that we went through, well, the hardships that we went through. You'll never forget them, really. If you don't remember their names, you remember their faces when they were young. You won't know them today, like on going on the honor flight. Would have never recognized none of them, even if I knew them. Sometimes I look at us old guys, I wonder, how the heck did we win this war? How did we win that war? You were young and the crazy, you know, we did think of our lives, you know, being killed and everything, but then we never thought it would happen to us. It was always somebody else. Not that we wanted it to be somebody else, but it just happened that way.
Well, I think I can speak for everybody listening when I say we're really glad you did win that war, because things would be very different. And I don't want to leave out anything that's important to you, but I do want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a story that only you could. My last question for you, 95 and a half years old, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I'm proud I was in that World War II and all the wars that I was in. I am really proud to serve my country, and I would do it all over again. I know I would. I really do.
And I know we all believe you. Calvin Pasetta, 95 years old of Las Vegas, Nevada, 30 years in the U.S. Navy. Check out some of his photos online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.